Is that working?
Wow, that sounds really loud. Makes me feel kind of big and important, rather than standing here thinking, oh my God, how am I going to live up to that fantastic introduction? One thing I would say about the introduction is he's covered so much, but it actually didn't take me very long to become skeptical about the paranormal. I just believed everything, you know, when I had some weird experiences myself. And then within about 3 or 4 years of doing experiments and not finding any telepathy, clairvoyance, precognition, ghosts, poltergeists, the evidence pretty quickly changed my mind. And then I became a kind of rent-a-skeptic, you know, going on all the telly programs. Have we got some telly people here? Television people? Only one, two. I expect it's the same in Germany as in England. You get some paranormal phenomenon and, you know, they used to do loads of it, like 99 people who've seen a ghost and Sue Blackmore to say it's all in the parietal lobe, or 150 people who've seen Jesus in the near-death experience and Sue Blackmore to say that we got a scientific explanation, and it's really, really tedious in the end. And I got out, and that was the year 2000. I just thought, I want nothing more to do with it. It's too depressing. So I got into some exciting stuff instead, which is where we will go today. So, why is all this stuff here? Can you see the pictures? No, you can't see the pictures. Can we have the big lights down even more? What a wonderful moaning noise. Great. Can you see all right? Can you see yourselves? I can see you, which is fine. And you can see a slightly bleary rainforest. Why is all this stuff here and all the animals and things hiding out of range of the camera? Well, I guess we all would say they've evolved. If we ask the same question about why is all this stuff here, we might be inclined, or some of you might be inclined, to say, well, that's completely different. That's intelligently designed. That's got a human brain that knows what it's doing and designs it. But the whole gist of everything that I'm going to say today is that that is not so. This is here for precisely the same reason, the evolutionary process. These things have evolved using us humans and our brains in order to do it, and our bodies, indeed. So that's going to be the major gist of what I want to talk about. And all this really depends on the best idea anybody ever had. Oh, I've got a stool. Somebody's put a stool here. I can sit down. Isn't that nice? The best idea anybody ever had. Isn't that a marvelous thought that there could be, in all this complex world, a best idea anybody ever had? Well, if there is, my prize goes the same place as the person who first said this, which is it's Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection. Who understands evolution by natural selection? I would expect 100% of hands to go up. And then I'd say, ha ha, yeah, but maybe you don't. Because it is so fundamental to the way we understand the world, that we really have to have a grasp on it. And it is, in a way, the most simple and the most beautiful idea, and yet somehow it slips out of our mental grasp. So, how many of you have read The Origin of Species? Hooray! George has read The Origin. Excellent. Or even a tiny bit of The Origin of Species? Good. Excellent. Well, for the rest of you, let me précis The Origin of Species in 3 sentences. The gist of Darwin's argument, which is brilliant, goes like this. If you have creatures that vary, which cannot be doubted because I've been to the Galapagos Islands and I've measured the size of the beaks of the finch and I've measured all the things and all sorts of variations, and 100 pages later. And if there is a struggle for life such that most of the variants die, which cannot be doubted because I've calculated if elephants bred all the time, the world would fill up completely with elephants, even though they're slowest breeding creatures, and I've done the calculations on them, and another 100 pages later. And if the few that survive pass on to their offspring whatever it was that helped them survive, and this cannot be doubted because I've done studies of the inheritance of characteristics and traits and blah, 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 and another 100 pages later, then the offspring must be better adapted to the circumstances in which that happened than their parents were. It's fantastic three-step algorithm. If you have variation, selection, heredity, then you must get... let me go to this one first. If you have variation, selection, and heredity, then you must get evolution, or as Dan Dennett calls it, design out of chaos without the aid of mind. This is the most fundamental idea in biology, and it's the most fundamental idea in everything that I'm going to say today. What do you think is my favorite word on that slide? If. Yeah, it's a very, very good word because it sets up the algorithm. Of course, Darwin had no concept of algorithms, but yeah, it's a good word. But no, it's not, my favorite one. Chaos? No. Any more suggestions? Nope. It's wonderful because it's without mind, so it's kind of important. No, my favorite word is must. This is what you have to grasp, and what so many students that I've taught, final year psychology students who just don't get this, even they think they do, that's the trouble, because, you know, all your life you learn about evolution and you think you get it, but you don't. The important bit to get, and the bit that will stop you dead being religious and believing in God, the designer, and all of that, is when you realize it must happen. It's inevitable. You get something, can we take some, I haven't got any strings. May I take your cup? Thank you. So, this cup, if we took this cup and we made 100 copies all slightly different and then set them out in the world to be used by people, some of them would get broken, some of them wouldn't taste very nice, some of them wouldn't work in the dishwasher, whatever. A whole lot of them would fail. And then we took the survivors and copied them and on and on and on. Inevitably, cups would get better in the environment in which all that happened. So that is the fundamental argument going on here. Now, how many of you have read this book, The Selfish Gene, Richard Dawkins? Good. I would recommend anyone who hasn't, I know how many books there are in the world. This book was written in 1976. That's coming on for 40 years ago. I looked it up on Amazon the other day. It's number 540. I mean, out of what, 6 million books, 7 million books, however many there are in English in Amazon. It's a stunning book because although a lot of the biology is dated, the basic principles not. And the principle of the selfish gene is he explained what I've just said about Darwin and all the ways that plays out in biology. But he emphasized in that book what he called universal Darwinism. And the whole story that he tells in that book is to say, look, it's not genes that are important. That's not really the point. What's important is this fundamental process, this three-step algorithm, this universal Darwinism. Anytime you have anything that is copied with variation and selection, then you must get evolution. So, at the end of the book, he said, the important point is that the information that is copied, can you hurry up, finish doing whatever you're doing with that bag? Thank you. So, the information that is copied with variation and selection is called the replicator. So genes are one replicator, and they're the one we know about. And he was trying to get his readers' minds away from an obsession with genes. And he said, is there any other replicator on this planet? Yes, just look around you. Everywhere you look, still swimming about in the primeval soup of culture, is a new replicator. Ideas, habits, stories, skills, clothes, traditions, ideas, theories, whatever, being copied from person to person. I want a name for the new replicator, and I hope my classicist friends will forgive me if I abbreviate mimeme, that is the Greek for that which is imitated, to meme, because it sounds a bit like gene. And so was the word meme born. And memes are defined in various ways. The dictionary definition is a unit of cultural transmission, but then you get all hung up on units because, here's a new meme for you. Don't know where that came from, but anyway, what's the unit in a human gesture or a, there are lots and lots of memes that can't be divided up into units. We have similar problems with genes, so that's not, so unusual. I prefer to stick to the core definition, which is that which is imitated, or that which is copied. So anything that is copied in human culture counts as a meme. And some examples, which I've mentioned. Now, I want to make it, before I move on to other things, I want to be sure that we understand that this concept of memes, because there's so many ways in which it can be misunderstood. Let me give you an example. So I turn up in my hotel last night, and I went into the bathroom, and I checked, and yes, there is this amazing meme that's gone all over the world. Do you know what I'm talking about? One of my favorite memes. How bizarre is this? It's everywhere. It's a ubiquitous meme. I was even in, my favorite example of it was I was traveling in Assam. I was visiting Buddhist monasteries in the Himalayas. And we were staying with a group of people in the eco camp with a great big tents. And out of the back of the tents was a simple building with toilets. And there it is. So this idea of folding up the end of your toilet roll seems to have spread all over the world, and sometimes it's not done very well, and sometimes people advertise their hotel with little stickers, and sometimes they kind of go overboard. I guess there's some function to this in showing that the bathroom has been cleaned, but it always amuses me because it just proves that somebody else has touched everything that you're going to use with their potentially dirty hands, so it actually makes things worse, not better. And that's the way with memes. So they're all over the place. We are surrounded by them. We live them. We use them. We just take them for granted. But they are competing all the time because there isn't enough room in the world. It's just like I explained with Darwin and looking at the finches and the elephants and everything else. Not all the elephants can survive. Not all the finches can survive. There is a struggle for life. And I would say there is a struggle for being copied if you are a meme. So memes are replicators, like genes are. They're a very, 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 very different kind of replicator from genes. Genes are copied by cellular chemistry inside the cells of your body. Memes are copied by speaking, writing, doing other things like that. But the fundamental underlying process, universal Darwinism, is exactly the same. And they are selfish replicators in the same way. Now, when we talk about a selfish gene, we don't mean that the gene is sitting somewhere in your body going, I want to get copied, I want you to get a mate. I mean, it's a string of DNA with bases in a certain order. It can't do anything like that. So what do we mean by saying it's selfish? We mean that it will get copied if it can, regardless of the consequences. A gene cannot care about the consequences because it's just a bit string of DNA. Obviously, as it can't care. That's the sense in which it's selfish. So when creatures are born and have miserable lives and die, or they might have happy lives, but, you know, it's not, it's because of the genes which ones get copied and which don't. But they don't care. They're just chemistry. The same thing with memes. So a story that is told, perhaps a horrible thing you read in the paper and you think, oh, this is so awful, and you tell somebody about it because you're upset, so you pass on the upset to another person who does the same thing. The memes themselves, the stories, the information written in the newspaper, that information that is copied with variation and selection doesn't care about the consequences for us or for our planet or for anything else. That's what it means to be selfish. So the way we look at it, if we can take a meme's eye view, is to imagine a world full of brains and far more memes than can possibly find homes. I would like you, please, to think about when you got up this morning. What was the first meme you met this morning when you woke up? Anybody got any ideas? No. You're all brain dead. Pun? Yes, yes, absolutely. Cleaning your teeth, washing your face, all those kinds of things, going to the loo. All those are memes because you wouldn't be doing them, you know, in a meme-free world. Before humans began imitating, there weren't any toothbrushes and you didn't clean your teeth. What else? I'm doing this because I want to make you think about the world you're in and the memes you are infected with every day. So what happens after that? looking at Twitter. Okay, if that's what you choose to do as soon as you've cleaned your teeth, or perhaps even before, okay, straight to the Twitter, absolutely. What's going on out there? I've got to know. Give me memes. Okay, what else? Newspapers. Okay, the news from all over the world. I must look at the newspaper. Yeah. Go on. We'll have a couple more. Getting dressed, all those clothes, yeah, and they're all... Coffee, breakfast, absolutely. Okay, so all of these things. Now, a lot of those are not going to affect you much. You do them every day, but the newspaper is. That's new stuff coming in the newspaper. The Twitter is. It's new stuff coming in. How much of that are you going to remember? Who was it said about Twitter? It was you. Can you remember all the Twitter feeds you read this morning? No, you can remember some, but not all. How many you'll remember tomorrow is another question. But also, how many have you passed on? Now, of course, before Twitter, if you read something, you'd have to pass, like this lecture. If you want to pass on anything I've said today, you've got to remember it, and then you've got to tell somebody about it or write it down on your blog or whatever you do. But it's all become easy now, because with Twitter, you just, retweet. this is part of what I'll come to you later. But the point is, so much stuff is coming in. All day today, you will be bombarded with words and ideas and stories and new theories and whatever. You won't remember all of them. You'll remember some. Of the ones you remember, you'll only pass on a few. That's the meme competition. That's the world of being what I would say we are. We are meme machines. And why are we meme machines? Because at some point in our ancestors' prehistory, somewhere between 2 million and 100,000 years ago, and we really don't know when, humans or our ancestors began to imitate with high enough fidelity that they could actually pass on things, vary them, select them, and let loose a new replicator. And that's quite a long time ago. And ever since then, we, completely differently from every other species on the planet, we have created this culture, and they haven't. Every other animal has to learn for itself. It can get a little bit through social learning, it can get a little bit through epigenetics and other stuff like that, but basically it has to learn to cope with the world on its own terms. And when it dies, its learning goes with it. For us, we pass on everything and accumulate cumulative culture. And we have a lot of choices. These are just some memes competing for our attention. And advertising, of course, is a mega one. So if we ask which memes succeed, I mean, here we have, all these overwhelming, I cannot go in supermarkets. I just get completely freaked out. Thank goodness I have a lovely husband who does all the food shopping, because I just freak out at the sight of something like that. It's too overwhelming. So the question is, which win and why? Well, I'd like to think of it as a continuum. It's probably a multidimensional space, but let's think of a continuum from those memes at one end, which we, the selective imitation devices, I would call us, we, the imitators, the meme machines, will choose certain memes because they're good, true, beautiful, useful in some way, they're valuable to us, and they really help us in some way. And at the other end of the continuum are the viral memes. Now, we have a problem here with the word viral memes because of the way it's used now. The analogy, and you always have to be very careful of analogies. They can be useful or they can be misleading. People talk about viral internet memes, meaning ones that they say gone viral. They mean they've had millions or billions of copies. Whereas normally if we're using that analogy, we mean something is viral, is that it's doing harm to the host and that it spreads to other hosts and does harm to them as well. So in my continuum, I'm using viral in that sense. And the most obvious, but not the only, the most obvious viral memes are classic trick ones like chain letters. And remember those hoax viruses that would say, here's the Trojan horse is going to destroy everything. Pass this message on to your friends. And then, the virus was that, not there wasn't any Trojan horse. All of those things, pyramid selling, all these financial tricks that people play. But I suppose to me the most interesting example is religions, which use precisely that structure. The copy me instruction, like genes have a copy me instruction when embedded in a cell. Some memes have a copy me instruction. Someone sends you something, copy this to everybody you know. Why should you do it? There's got to be some kind of trick to make you do it. And religions have all the best tricks because they have evolved for thousands of years, most of the major religions. And the tricks they use, they're so kind of obvious, and yet they still work. You believe this, or you die. You believe this, or when you die, you go to hell. They also, I mean, the extraordinary thing about religions is, I've just chosen a few pictures here, the way they change people's entire lives. They use enormous quantities of resources, not just building beautiful Cologne Cathedral and all of that, but the beautiful music and all these wonderful things that lure you in. And why do you not just go, wow, this is fantastic and beautiful? Instead, you go, wow, the glory of God, because at least to some extent, you are promised. You are promised and you're threatened. What I don't really get is why people haven't invented a heaven. What would your heaven be? I mean, it wouldn't be sitting on a fluffy cloud with lutes, would it? What would it be? Pardon? A Twitter-free environment. Okay. I think we could probably divide everybody here into two. There'd be the ones where I want a heaven without all that, and the other ones who go, I want broadband instantly into my head all the time and everything. Anyway, I don't think it'd be this. But still, these things still work. So this is just some idea of how memeplexes, that's co-adaptive complexes of memes that work together in groups, like religions, like scientific theories, like financial institutions, all these kinds of things, like telecom companies. These things are groups of memes that include within themselves all sorts of reasons why they hold themselves together, why they get passed on and why they succeed, and the constant battle to keep, each against each other. So that's a quick kind of flip through memetics as I see it. Most of what I've said there, I think, would be acceptable to people who are interested in memes, although it's extremely controversial amongst most biologists, evolutionary, as the introduction mentioned. This is a different approach from sociobiology, from evolutionary psychology, that starts always from the genes. So this way we think about the world in terms of two replicators, not one. We think about human nature in terms of two replicators, not one. And all the rest of the species on this planet have only one replicator. And the stuff that I'm going to go on and talk about afterwards is very much more controversial, and an awful lot of it is new ideas I've never talked about before, and I'm trying out on you. So I hope you will enjoy that, and I hope you will help me to... I like to stick my neck out, and I think the man speaking from telecom this morning kind of implied the same thing, didn't you? Where is he? Yes, I hope I understood you correctly to, like, I'm going to stick my neck out, I don't mind, you bite my head off, kindly bite my head off, and we'll see where we go. So, before I go on to all that, any questions about memes? Because I'd rather you really understood what I'm talking about before I move on to other stuff. Any questions? Yeah. Yes, this constant interplay between what we are as a biological organism and what we are when we take on the memes. So you first wake up in the morning, you could be a simple human living thousands of years ago without all this stuff. It's kind of like the brain is booting up. What it's doing is taking in this. It happens very fast in most people, and they don't notice it. Some people, it happens very slowly, and they can describe it. Maybe you're one of those. So you probably don't open your eyes first. There's probably dream imagery left, which lots of all advanced animals dream, as far as we know, and what's going on in their brain. So there's bits of that. They'll go away as you start to listen. You start to think, the thought, where am I? And there's a bed and all that stuff. And then comes the stuff. And then you said you thought about yesterday. Well, that's going to be meme stuff, very likely, because it'll be where you went on the bus or what, whatever, all these meme stuff. And then it'll all come back. Language, which isn't sort of booted up instantly after you've done the where am I, who am I, what, that's the ceiling. Then comes all the meme stuff. Any more questions? Yeah.
You talked about... thank you. You talked about... Okay, you talked about memes being characterized as beautiful, interesting, and this, that, and the other. Those characterizations, are they memes in themselves? Or you know,
good question. Well, of course, the words are, the concepts are,
right,
in a way.
Exactly.
And then, okay, so we also heard in the introduction that there'll be terrible philosophical problems. And if you want me to solve the problem of the nature of meaning or knowledge, and epistemological problems and so on, I'm not a philosopher.
Right.
Help, I can't. But those concepts are, yes. But in a more down-to-earth way, and forgetting the philosophical conundrums here, think of a species that is just beginning to imitate, as our ancestors would have been, my guess would be 300,000 or 500,000 years ago. They're beginning to imitate. What are they going to imitate? Once you've got an imitation mechanism, it's got to be selective. Because if you start imitating the person who lights the fire wrong and sets fire to himself and dies, you know, that's not very good. You've got to start being selective. And that's why I have called human brains a selective imitation device, because I think that's our primary function. And so really what is more interesting about the continuum is not what we call things, but it's this struggle of a human brain over generations of design to, by and large, on the whole, pick things that are valuable to the organism and will help it pass on its genes, you know, this interplay of the two replicators, rather than dangerous things that will waste its resources and kill it off. So that's a way of looking at it, which I think you can sort of get away from the philosophical problems.
Thank you.
Yes. The microphone's coming.
What drives the imitation? Why is one meme superior to the other?
There's two questions there, and the first one is a very interesting, what drives it. I mean, just because you can imitate, why should you? I would say probably because these early imitators, all human societies and chimp and, I mean, most other animals' societies, certainly the social animals, have a huge drive for status, for having friends, allies, reciprocal altruism, all of those things. You want to be the one who's seen to have the good stuff. Other people want to get it from you. If you can light fires and nobody else can, you know, you're a winner. And then, well, then what if you put feathers in your hair or you start putting clothes on and you keep warmer and, you know. So the useful memes, sorry, the dodginess of these philosophical words, but, you know, the useful things like keeping a fire alight and putting clothes on and keeping warm in a cold climate as humans spread northwards from Africa would have been very important. But you could not expect a brain to be, right from the start, able to imitate only the useful things. Because the successful ones who are going to get high status, good mates, pass on their genes and so on, are going to be the ones who get status, perhaps showing off, perhaps if they started... Dan Dennett does a whole story about drumming. And if the males were drumming, because we're talking of a species, you know, with males and females selecting males, and the males are drumming, and the females are going to pick the one with the best drumming, you know, then you get all kinds of imitation going. So the drivers there will be all the usual things, status, mate, getting mates, and so on. And so here we are with this enormous drive, which has led us to where we are now. Let's have one more question, and then I'll move on.
Well, aren't you describing a sociological effect of the creation of the ego in the individual, when you talk about this, you know, the drive driven by the ego being an artificial, essentially, element in the mind created in order to control the individual by society. Am I not right?
Ooh. Well, I'm not entirely sure how you're using the word ego, whether you're talking about a kind of Freudian sort of an ego or a more modern sense of the ego. I think Freud had... It'd be nice to be able to say Freud was 100% wrong about everything, but he wasn't, which makes it more complicated. He did have the occasional good idea, but his idea of the ego is... So I would prefer to talk about the self, which there's masses of fantastic neuroscience going on about the construction of the self. So we know that, for example, there's an area in temporoparietal junction here where the body image is constructed and the self image is constructed, and it takes in information from all the senses and builds up this thing. We also know from developmental psychology with children how early they separate me from my body. And they attribute, that, you know, if you ask them questions like, well, when the body dies, does the person still want such and such a thing? And little children, even like 4 and 5, will say, well, when they do it usually with a mouse. When the mouse is dead, will he still want food? No, they don't eat food when they're dead. When the mouse is dead, will it still like its friend, the other mouse? Oh, yes, it will still do that. This very early on, this concept of the mental self and the physical world, it comes. And we end up dualists. We end up believing that there's a me inside here. And you used the word control. In fact, the self doesn't really have any control. It's a temporary, in my opinion, it's a temporary fleeting construction. Comes and goes, constructed as needed, falls away, constructed as needed, falls away. All the causal stuff going on in the brain is, some of it goes through that process, but most of it doesn't. Most of the things, I mean, goodness, look at all the things I'm doing, waving my arms around. I mean, they're not connected up in any sense with the self concept. They're just a machine operating, and same with the words. They're just, you know. As for control by society, well, yeah, you're right, that's a sociological thing. But I think the concept of self is prior to that. So it's much more a mimetic thing when societies start to use that to get control. Right, shall we move on? Is everybody happy about the concept of memes? I could perhaps say one more thing about memes, that if you start to get in a muddle, if everything is a meme, then the concept is useless. If nothing's a meme, the concept is useless. So if you think in your mind, well, is that a meme or not? Ask yourself, was it copied from somewhere else? So things that you learn, like, for example, skiing is a good example. Fantastic. I love skiing. And I really love bashing those moguls. Now, something, who I used to, I'm getting too old now, really, but I have to try and be careful. But that skill, that, you know, all those physical movements, they are learned, and other animals can learn those by individual personal learning. That's not a meme. Nobody can watch me, but then you have to learn for yourself. I watch my ski instructor, I can try and copy it, but I have to go out and learn it myself. Clutch control in a car, all sorts of things that we do, those are learned by ordinary learning. But the concept of skiing and putting the things on your feet and all of that, those are all memes. So that's the question to ask if you're a bit confused about whether something's a meme or not. Did I learn it for myself? Did I invent it myself? Or is it copied from somewhere else? And that should help. So let me carry on. Something's been worrying me. We go to... I want you to take this kind of flip in your head. Richard Dawkins likened it when he talked about taking the gene's eye view, the selfish gene view, as being like a Necker cube. I expect you're familiar with a Necker cube. You can see it in two different ways. Can you all flip that? Yeah? Can you flip the two views? You should be able to get control of the flipping. You should be able to see the two views. So what I'm talking about here is thinking about the world of memes from the memes I view. Selfish memes. I mean, a meme, like I was saying, like a story in the newspaper, it's only a story in a newspaper. It's black and white stuff on paper. Nevertheless, it has replicator power. It's going to go out there and get some people to read it and not others and so on and so on. So you're looking from the memes I view. What does the meme want? And when I say want, put big inverted commas, because I could expand that to say, instead of want, if it can get copied, it will, without regard for the consequences. The only want that memes have is, or genes or any replicator, is to get more copies made. So that's a flip. You start to see the world from a different point of view. And what I would like you to do, and hope you can do in the next however long, is be able to take that flip and flip back and flip back. It's not that the memes I view or the genes I view is the right view. It's that it's a completely different way of seeing things in the world, which would help you understand a whole lot of stuff in a different way. But then for other purposes, you need to flip back again. So with that in mind, let's go back to this question about the memes that win. And something has been bothering me for quite a long time, 10 years or so, since I started thinking about memes. Is there something new happening? There's the people around the fire, and there's the feathers in their hat, and there's all the food and the books, and there's Google. Is this something fundamentally different, or is it just more memes? Is selection and copying by search engines and so on, is it something different? Is the fact that it's based on digital information processed in silicon-based machinery, is that fundamentally different or is it the same? And that question really bothered me for quite a long time. And I now have some answers in my own mind that I want to share with you, some of which, if any of you have seen my TED lecture, that's where I first talked about a possible third replicator. And I've done a lot more thinking about it since then, and it seems to kind of be coming together. So, early memes, in that picture that we had there, the cavemen kind of thing. And if you think that's a really stupid picture, that's the picture that Scientific American used to illustrate my article about memes. So it's got to be scientific, even though it looks a bit daft. But anyway, there they are. Those kind of memes, lighting fires, gestures, sounds, early kind of language, and those sorts of things, don't leave any traces. They're not very good replicators. The usual way of thinking about what makes a good replicator is that it has high fidelity, fecundity, longevity. In other words, lots of copies are made with very high fidelity copying, and they last a long time. Well, words, gestures, and things are not like that. But as memetic evolution has gone on, they've got better and better. And so if we start with writing, that increases fidelity because you commit to what's written down. It also increases longevity because a clay tablet like that, well, it's still here. I mean, this is thousands of years old, this clay tablet, and the message written on it is still readable today. So that's longevity and a half. And then you get printing. And that, of course, increases fecundity. The clay tablet took a very long time for somebody to laboriously carve. And in order to copy it, as with scribes in medieval texts and so on, a human being has to come along and do it the hard way. But you get printing presses and it increases it. Perhaps not so obvious as meme increasing or replicator increasing technology are ways of moving stuff around. Because when people could only walk to the next village, most people in their lifetime didn't go more than a few miles from where they were born. But as transport increases, people move around more, and they take the memes with them, and they bring back new memes. You go and visit a city, if you live some faraway place, and you get on a train, in the Victorian times, for example, people started going all over England on the very first trains, and they'd come to a city and they'd discover all these amazing things, and then they'd want to be in the city because it's got all sorts of cool stuff that they didn't have in their boring village. And so that's how it goes on, and endless evolution of transport. And the same kind of thing with cars, and we move around an awful lot more. You may notice that bottom right-hand picture of the map. You may think, that's just a coincidence that it looks a bit like that. Not a coincidence. These are just two versions of where information will survive by communicating. Our bodies are built up from a history of this kind of thing. As a whole bunch of cells living together, they can't get very big unless it's got oxygen being taken and other and nutrients and so on, and you get these kind of organized structures with branching structures and so on, as you do with roads. And I'll come back to this later because I think it's quite important. But things are spreading in new ways that people didn't predict probably even 30 or 40 years ago. This was on the same trip where I photographed the pointy toilet thing in Assam. We went over the most phenomenal pass, the Sela Pass, into Arunachal Pradesh in northeast India, which has only opened up to visitors of any kind fairly recently. And we were almost an entire day slithering on hairpin bends on mud and finally over this very, very high pass down into this beautiful place here. And you can see up on the hill there a monastery, which is much as it has been for thousands and thousands of years. There were boys playing cricket in the yard outside. I thought that was fantastic. There's another meme, the English cricket meme, which has gone to India with such fervor. But why I show you this picture, I suspect that there have been cows grazing there for thousands of years as well. No, not thousands, but certainly hundreds in a similar place. But you turn round and go just down the valley, just looking the other way, and this is what you see. An incredibly poor little town called Tawang with a few shops. And in those shops, there's saucepans, rice, very simple food, vegetables, pencils and paper, that sort of thing. Very, very simple stuff, and very and clothes, and televisions and satellite dishes, and mobile phones. They've leapt over all the other stuff. They would rather have this than anything else. And I went into very, very simple little houses there, and every one that I went in had a television, and it was right in the middle, and it was the most important thing. This is only a few years ago. So this is how it's all spreading now. And the way that I think about this is it's a co-evolutionary process. We are the driving force in the sense that we want the information. And what your question about what drives us to imitate, that's kind of lurking there, and I'm glad you asked that. It's sort of lurking. But why are we driving? Because if I've got some story that you haven't got, I've got kind of power. I heard the news first. I'm the news spreader. You know, all that sort of thing. You want to be on top of things. You want, it's all to do with status. So you want the information. So, of course, you have to buy the latest gadget. Well, once the latest gadget's brought, then more information comes, and other people want that gadget. And this co-evolutionary process goes on between the memes and the machinery for copying them. Well, is all this just more memes, or is there something fundamentally different going on? And I want to argue that there's something fundamentally different going on. And I mentioned the TED lecture in which I gave a very brief version of this, and I'm now thinking about it in a way that adds to that, I hope, useful ways. So what I've tried to do is to think about how we got from the first replicator to the second replicator, and see whether this could give us some purchase on how we might get from a second replicator to a third replicator. So what happened in this first transition? So the way that biology works, at least most, in certainly most animals, you have the genome. You have your genotype is the order of all the bases on the DNA molecules in every cell of your body. That describes a massive information, fantastic amount of information that codes for the production of your body, or codes for the production of a fern or a flowering plant or a tree or a frog or an insect or this fly or anything. And that's called the phenotype. The phenotype is the properties of the fly. So this fly, because it's got genes for, or that code for, big eyes, the phenotype will have bigger eyes. But the DNA is just the information stored inside the cells. So you have this very important distinction between the genotype and the phenotype. And the information for making the phenotypes is passed down the germline. It's called the germline. So when you have children, they don't inherit the things that your phenotype has inherited. So, for example, I've got a really weird, wonky hand, and I was born with that. But it's not genetic. It was probably because the cord was twisted around in the womb or something of that kind. We don't really know. My children have perfectly normal hands because I've passed on my genes for how hands are made. Right? So that's how it works. So how did the second replicator, the memes, come about? Well, first of all, they produced these creatures by, you know, successive rounds of ordinary biological evolution until one of those phenotypes, one of those bodies made by the genotypes, became capable of imitation. And as soon as you have humans who are capable of imitation, you let loose a new replicator. This is why I've referred to humans as Earth's Pandoran species. Pandora as in, we let this thing out of the box. Or our ancestors let this thing out of the box. This was not kind of evolution with foresight or God coming along and saying, oh, how about a species that can imitate? It was probably because under most environments, you are better either to learn everything for yourself anew every time. If an environment is changing very, very fast, then each creature, each, you know, new generation had better learn it for itself how to cope in that environment. If the environment is changing very, very slowly, then you're much better to put everything into the genome, and every creature is born knowing how to walk, eat, whatever it might be it needs to do. Only in between, in a slightly variable environment, and it seems to be quite a narrow condition, is it worth getting imitation. Now, imitation is quite high. It requires a lot of information processing resources. Perhaps we could invent a new meme. Would you like to volunteer? Or would anybody like to volunteer to invent a new meme? Some brave person must be willing. Come on. I'd like you to come and stand up here for me, please. Right. When I say go, I want you to just do any little thing that everyone can see. You could sing or dance or just stand on your head or do anything. It doesn't have to be anything very dramatic, okay? Ready, steady, go. Good. Okay. Now, so stay there, stay there. Did I do it right?
Maybe, I don't remember.
Oh, hopeless. Did I do it right? Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Now, the point of that is if you think about what it took for me to imitate. I tried to look as though I was thinking very hard. I didn't have to think very hard. It's pretty easy. I went, it's not very accurate. It's an analog kind of imitation, which, of course, is less high fidelity and so on and so on. But the point is, in order to do that, I had to watch what she did, put that into memory from this viewpoint, convert that into actions of this body that would look to you lot as though they were the same thing that she did. You see, it's computationally quite heavy-handed, which is why it's only in the last really few years that we have robots that imitate, and they're not very good at it, and it's really quite hard stuff to do. So it looks like in our evolutionary past, imitation came about probably because it was useful in that rapidly changing, in between speed changing environment, with no foresight. Genes didn't have any foresight what's going to happen, and imitation started, and then people started imitating all these things, lighting fires, wearing clothes, talking, above all talking, making noises, copying noises, making those noises under certain circumstances so that you get a reference and then you've got the beginnings of language and so on. So we let out of the box this new thing. So to recap, the genes make phenotypes. One of those phenotypes became capable of imitation. And now we humans are so good at imitation that we just take it for granted that we can do it. Do you have the game Simon Says in Germany? Yes? Let me explain to you the rules of Simon Says. It's a wonderful children's game, and you're going to play it, okay? It goes like this. I am going to say, Simon says, do whatever, something, and then you have to do it. But if I say do something, but I don't say Simon Says, you mustn't do it, okay? Are you up for this game? Okay. Simon says, do this. Simon says, do this. Simon says, do this. Do this. Na, 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 got you. Oh, you put your hands down very quickly, didn't you? You get it? We've got some 4- and 5-year-olds here, I'm afraid. What happens is kids of sort of 7, 8, 9, 10 are pretty good, probably as good as you lot. But 3- and 4-year-olds absolutely can't suppress imitation. You know, that's the point of the game. I was lucky enough once when I was presenting a television program about, it was called The Cleverest Ape in the World. Oh, you television people, you can imagine this, can't you? This is Channel 4. The Cleverest Ape in the World. Sue Blackmore travels the world to find the cleverest ape. She studies 4 apes, mostly in zoos. And lo and behold, one of them's cleverer than her. Yay! Because it's doing some task it's done a million times that requires enormous strength that the chimpanzee had and I didn't have, but, you know, made a good program. Anyway, amongst all this, I was introduced to a wonderful orangutan called Chantek, who I was told could play Simon Says. But when it actually came to it, the carer, would say, Simon says, put the twig on the blanket, and he would do it. He did it, he was 28 years old. He did it incredibly slowly and laboriously and looking at her all the time. He'd been trained really well. He could just about imitate. So we do have imitation in other ape species, but it's really hard. And there is no way that he could play Simon Says as we've just played it here. I went into that little bit of fun just to give you an idea. It's like, you know, any of you who know anything about artificial intelligence, you know how, you know, apparently Marvin Minsky said to, gave a project to a graduate student to make machine vision in the summer holidays. And 40 years on, we still don't have very good machine vision. Well, it's getting better. Because we open our eyes and see, we think it's easy. But actually something like a quarter of our brain is devoted, quarter of the cortex is devoted to visual analysis. And it's the same with imitation. We find it so easy, we take it for granted. So, sorry, that's just a bit of a detour there about how this came about. So, given that that's how the second replicator came about, could we see the same thing happening again? Well, it doesn't seem to quite work, because most memes in the world, when I speak or say something, when I do whatever, I've forgotten your meme now. You know, this there's no division between the germline and the phenotype. I'm copying the product, if you like. I copy. When we speak to somebody and then we repeat what they said, there isn't any equivalent. You could argue, and some people do, well, there's instructions in the brain for producing the words, but it's actually the words that we copy. So there isn't a phenotype. Ah, but I would argue that in the modern world, we have the beginnings of this. Because when you buy a car, it is not built by copying the other car that looks the same. It's built by you buy the car, and another one is made from the production line in the factory. When you read a book, or when lots of copies of the books are made, they're not copied. You know, every copy of The Selfish Gene wasn't copied from a previous copy of The Selfish Gene. It was copied from the plates or the whatever they, more digital now. And the same with all the stuff that we buy. But none of those phenotypes, or whatever you might like to call them, phemotypes, some people call them, are capable of copying, just the same as all the other animals who are not capable of imitation. But what about this lot? Well, yeah. So I think exactly the same step has happened again. That is, the first replicator produced a body that turned out to be able to copy in another way, and that let loose memes. And now the memes have produced bodies, phenotypes, and one of those, or one type of those, has become capable of copying in another way. It's copying digital information on silicon-based machinery. I would say that it's possibly a third replicator. So then I ask myself, well, how would we decide whether it really is a new replicator? Well, let's go back to the basic definitions. If something is information copied with variation and selection, then that's what we would call a replicator. So is it copying? Well, of course, all these computers and phones and laptops and tablets, they're all copying information and storing it with amazingly high fidelity. Do they vary it? Well, yes, of course. But is it us doing the varying? For a very long time, it was us doing the varying. What was that? Was it that? Because it sounded like behind me. I was like, there's something happening. I think I'm going to die. So for a long time with early computers, I built one of those Sinclair ZX80s out of a kit, you know, and then I had a BBC Micro. Wow! And you could write my first book, all the chapters are the same length because the maximum file size on a BBC Micro was about the right length for a chapter, and I just saw it running out of space. Okay, I better start a new chapter. How much it's changed. In those days, all the varying was done by humans. But is the varying now done by the machines themselves? Well, yes, it is. For example, there are actually programs now that will write newspaper stories and they go in the newspapers. I mean, how scary is that? Because they just get fed with a few bits of information and they make up kind of convincing sounding stories that might have been made by a journalist. And then what happens? What about the selecting? Well, the machines are doing the selecting, aren't they? Google is doing it all the time, and other search engines. So you could say that only in the last few years, I would say, there is a third replicator in our midst. Well, that we think we've created. I would say we have no more created it than the early hominins before Homo sapiens sapiens evolved created this. It happened because it must happen. Remember that word? When you have information copied with variation, selection, heredity, you must get evolution. So I would say that we have now, or if not, we will have tomorrow or the next day, present shock. Yes, what a brilliant name. I really like that. So then I had to decide what to call it. And this is why I got myself in such terrible, terrible hot water. I decided for various reasons we'd have genes, memes, and teams. And that's what I said in the TED lecture and in a couple of articles I've written. But it's such a bad name because people think it's T-E-A-M-S and they get muddled up and it's hopeless. Richard Dawkins is really angry with me and he said it ought to be threams because it's the third replicator. But I've thought for a long time, and I put out a thing in New Scientist where people wrote in, I had 32 different possible names, but none of them came out on top, and I didn't do anything about it. But you are the starting point for me saying, no, it's not going to be teams, it's going to be treams. Because that kind of tri-third replicator kind of thing, and it rhymes with memes. Goodness knows whether it will be a successful meme, but that's what I've decided, and if you think you've got a better idea, please tell me. So, here we have the treams. So what's the significance of this? One bit of significance is that we've already had our brains turned into meme machines. I would say that's why we have such big brains. Human brains are ludicrously large compared with any other related species. Arguably four times as large as they ought to be if we were just an ordinary ape, and hundreds of times as large as they ought to be if we were like most creatures on the planet. So we've been turned into meme machines. Well, now we're being turned into tree machines, I would say. Little kids are not only learning to read, which co-opts parts of the brain that were never designed for that purpose, but now they're being taught very early on. Now, I went to typing school when I was 18 to learn to type. Nobody learns to type now. They're practically born typing. You know, they just kind of got these things from so young. They don't have typing lessons at school. They have IT lessons, and they just get on with it. And look how happy they are. But what's going on there? Is this the children using the things for their own benefit, or is it the things using the children for their own benefit? Remember the Necker cube? These are the two ways you can look at it. And I want you to be able to look at it from both ways. So, where is it leading? Ta-da! Well, is it really like that? I mean, where is all this stuff? Just take this room. I mean, really, look at the gadgets spread around. Some of these are on, and they're communicating with what? Well, potentially, in here now, I bet some of you are online. You're connected up to the cloud. We are all connected up to it. Ah, we think it's for our own benefit, don't we? Well, we've got another continuum, haven't we? I wonder, is this, let's call it the cloud. I know that means a specific part of it, but let's call it that. This cloud, we'll call it the octopus if you prefer, cloudopus. Is this cloudopus anything like a human brain? Could it be intelligent in its own right? Could it be conscious? Yes, it is incredibly much like a human brain. Remember the roads and the veins and arteries? Well, let's think of some similarities between this stuff and a human brain. One of the problems with the human brain, and thank you for asking about selves and egos and stuff, because the way most people, and from very young, think about themselves is, I am me, I'm inhabiting my body. I'm inside here, this is my body, I'm in charge, I control it. As though there is some central something. There is no middle in the brain. There is no center. The brain isn't like that. It's a massively, massively parallel device. There are hierarchical parts within it. There are parts of the visual system that are hierarchical. But on the whole, there are something like 40 parallel pathways in the visual system, and they never all come back together again. Right from the start, the information comes in your eye, goes up through the optic nerve, goes into the part of it goes into the superior colliculus in the thalamus, and that controls eye movements and body movements to make sure you're looking the right way. That never comes back with the rest, just does that job very fast. The rest goes through the lateral geniculate nucleus and into the cortex, where some of it goes off to control actions. A lot of it goes in the dorsal stream up the back here and goes to control movements. Other stuff goes much slower into the ventral stream and controls recognition and verbalizing and all of those things. And it never comes back together again. Well, think of that out there. It's taking in information all over the place. It's doing different jobs in parallel. It's sending it out. It's sending you messages. It's getting them in. It's very much like a human brain. Well, could it be intelligent? Well, of course. I mean, it's doing thinking in a mega way, isn't it? Could it be conscious? I think to be conscious, it would kind of, well, at least to be conscious in a way that we think about, it's got to be able to see, hasn't it? I had a strange experience in my garden the other day. I went out through the garden off to the field where I was going to look at the sheep and get some wood for the wood stores. And I'll just show you something that happened to me. I hope the sound works. Yes. See, I didn't dress up for the occasion. There's my little encounter. In case you'd like to know how we made it, here you go. Three of us doing that. I've got the controls here, but obviously I didn't have at the time. But we had a lot of fun making that. So, it was looking at me, and I was looking at it. Now, that noise. Right. On that particular machine that you saw there, there's a phone on the top, which recorded all the video, which we used. But that could easily then be connected up to the cloud. What fascinated me about this friend of mine just turned up last week with this quadcopter. and said, "Look at my look at this fun toy. I want one. I don't really want one. I've had some fun with it, you know. But I can see how many people are going to want them. They're going to want them really, really badly. At the moment, they cost about €1,000. But, you know, the more people who want them, the more they'll come down. We've got this co-evolutionary process again. So this thing will be, in addition to Google Earth and Street View and all of those things which can look at the world, you've only got to have, you know, a few billion of these flying around, which I expect will happen, and the whole cloud is able to see everything going on as much as it wants to, far better than a human could, and with this massive processing capacity that we have made for it. I hope you can see what I'm getting at here. We're doing this voluntarily. And I kind of wasn't acting there. I mean, my friend just said to me, "Oh, I'll buzz it round you and we'll film a bit, you know?" And I was like, "Oh, my God, what?" Yeah. And then I was like, "Hang on a minute, it's got an eye and I'm going to look into it." And then I just thought it was really fun and I really liked it. And I was like, "Hello." And, you know, that's how we are as humans. And so we'll make more and more of these things. We will pour in the resources, won't we? And what will our role be? And we can't stop this thing. There is absolutely no way that we could conceivably stop everything that we've done now. I mean, any attempt to shut down the internet, just imagine you'd have to destroy every single machine on the planet. It couldn't be done because they've all got copies of, well, not all of them, but there are so many copies of all the necessary protocols now that you couldn't get rid of it. Like you can't get rid of certain bacteria off the planet and so on. They're just here to stay. So, what is our role going to be in this thing with which we are interacting all the time and voluntarily giving ourselves to? I don't know, are any of you here biologists? Know about mitochondria? Or maybe not your biologists, then you know what mitochondria are? They're the little powerhouses inside all our cells. So you have these intracellular structures, lots of different things going on inside every cell in your body. But the mitochondria are really important because they provide the energy for every cell to keep alive. And they're producing ATP and other fundamental chemicals for energy use. How did they come about? Well, this was mysterious for a long time. But nowadays, the most popular theory was actually invented in the 1970s, and people thought it was complete rubbish. It's called endosymbiosis. And what appears to have happened is that the eukaryote, a larger bacterium cell, engulfed one of the prokaryotes, a smaller, simpler cell, literally engulfed it, and it came to live inside. This is mutually beneficial for both cells, because the big one now doesn't have to bother with energy production. It can get on with its jobs of protecting itself and growing and having structural elements and communicating with other cells and all the other things it has to do, and its energy is provided by the mitochondrion. The mitochondrion now can give up protecting itself, getting food, and all the other things that it used to have to do when it was a free living cell. It doesn't do those things anymore, got rid of all that stuff, and just sits inside the cell. It's outsourced all those tasks to the engulfing cell. And that, it seems to me, is the best analogy that I can give to what's happening to us. We are willingly giving up all sorts of capacities to live freely, to think freely, to be independent, and giving ourselves over to this machine, this massive machine. A machine that consists of the billions of digital processing units that are all interconnected all over the planet. And are we just producing the energy? Yes, we are. We are going and digging up all the silicon and the titanium and all the other things that we need. We are investigating fracking. We are destroying the planet using all of this carbon-based fuel. We're digging new oil wells all the time. We're building new hydroelectric plants with all of the resource implications that that has. And why are we doing it? Well, think of that Necker cube again. We think we're doing it for our own fun. But from a different point of view, we are being sucked willingly into this. We're so willing. We so want Twitter, except for the person whose heaven would have no Twitter. We are mostly being sucked very willingly into this. This is how I see the way it's going now. And all I have done here is to take some very basic biological principles and see if they apply, and I think they do. So that is what I think, that we're being absorbed into this giant chi machine. And that's where we are today. It's present shock. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Susan, for this really great and provocative talk, especially with the outlook that you gave at the end. And I think there's lots to discuss, and we now have, I think, about 15 minutes or so until our first coffee break. And before discussing this outlook, maybe I have a more basic understanding question about sort of continuity and rupture. Because if I remember sort of my biology class right, biological evolution goes in little steps, and there is sort of this continual process of genes or organisms that mutate, and some variations are selected, others are not. And with the memes, I wonder, sort of in culture, you often have descriptions of rupture. How do you explain the advent of totally new, or maybe just apparently new stuff, such as avant-garde art movements or revolutions with the idea of democracy in the U.S. in the 1770s? Can you, sort of what are the precursors, and can you create this sort of line or chain of being in with the memes as well?
Well, first of all, when you mentioned the chain of being, do you know what that is, the chain of being? As you know, it's like people who believe in a teleological approach to evolution, things get better and better and better and better and end up with humans. But it isn't like that. it's a bush of beings, and we're just one in a whole great mass. But there's been long arguments in biology about whether changes are saltations, really. Stephen Jay Gould thought, the big arguments between him and Dennett and Dawkins and people about whether you get these sudden leaps or whether everything is really gradual. And in archaeological time, of course, it's really hard to tell, because what looks sudden to us from now wasn't so sudden then. But I think exactly the same thing is happening. And, well, you've said so yourself, really, that in culture you get those things. But the process is very understandable. Something will be selected for, and as long as the environment, as long as that niche is available for whatever it is that's been selected to survive, it'll go on surviving. The English language has gone on a very long time, and hundreds of years at any rate, and it keeps going, and it keeps adapting to new circumstances. But you need new languages for certain processes. So if you invent Fortran and Algol and C++ and I don't know whatever else, and those make a sudden change. Yes, I would say it's exactly the same process.
I think it boils sort of down to the question of what is the mutation rate. And it seems in memes or in human culture it's higher than in sort of biological evolution. And now with the trends, might it not go down again, because sort of digital copying, these are perfect copies. I mean, at least in theory, we know that in practice, also digital copying, there are errors and variations. But so I wonder sort of how that affect the future of this new replicator, that the rate of mutation will be different than with the memes.
That's a very interesting question and quite tricky. When we tend to think about biology and biological change, mutation is the idea that comes up. But really, we should be thinking more about sources of variation, because go back to copying with variation and heredity. So the variation that comes about from mutation is very important in biology, and it comes about because strings of DNA get broken or affected by all sorts of things. If there are copying errors, there's massive error correcting mechanisms going on that put things right. They're keeping the fidelity as high as it possibly can be. But actually, the major source of variation is not mutation. It's actually recombination in sexually operating species. So your mother's and your father's chromosomes put together, crossed over, divided up again, so you get a different mixture. So most of the variation's coming about that way. Now, when you go to memes, you think, well, what's the equivalent of mutation? Well, it's something like, the scribes copying the Bible out and they changed a word by mistake or something of that kind. But there are all sorts of other sources of variation. I mean, every time you tell a story, you'll probably tell it a bit differently from the way you heard it. Or you invent a new story. You take all the words you knew, and some of you have written a novel or a play or something, You took words that you knew, ideas that came from elsewhere. You took a whole bunch of memes, and you put them together in a new way. So it's think variation rather than specifically mutation. And when it comes to the teams, is it going to slow down? Well, the very high fidelity is a good thing, as long as you've got sources of variation. But as I described, there are so many programs out there doing variations, constructing, taking old stuff, constructing new stuff out of it. Our lives are full of that now.
Yeah, and it's a fast evolution, the technological one.
And so another thing is that evolutionary processes tend to speed up. As you get more available variation from which to select, they inevitably speed up. I mean, they may slow down and various other things happen, but in the wide scoop, they speed up. So that's why we've had genes for 4 billion years, we've had memes for a few hundred thousand years, and we've had dreams for, depending what you think, either a week or not quite yet, or maybe 10 years.
Let me open this up and let's have a conversation. So what are your questions or comments?
There's a hand been waving over there for a long
Jens
time.
Best, bitte.
I guess English or German or... English.
Ich kann nicht Deutsch.
Okay.
Entschuldigung.
Well, there's some memes in German you missed. Then.
Yeah, I know. I'm deprived.
I would like to push the envelope a little bit then, because I think talking about memes is a starting point. Like we are talking about the European identity in the digital age, I guess today and tomorrow, on an arc over the whole conference, and I think that. When I think of the future of consciousness, I like to start on the meme. Like I start when I talk about digital, I start with zero and one. But as we talking about European identity, we're talking about 0.3 and 1.1 and minus 1.5, you know. And so, like, bring a non-American perspective to the whole thing, because like, what is the future of consciousness beyond zero and one? And I think that. Talking about memes, we have to start with imitations. We have to think about empathy, about mirror neurons. Mirror neurons.
Oh, mirror neurons.
Spiegelneuron. Uh-huh. And how this is, how is social interaction and the learnings we have, the new learnings we have about the brain reconnecting with the digital sphere, and the comparisons you made, like the whole net thing, you know, like the octopus thing and it thing, which is there, but oh, maybe not. I think there's no it. I think there's a lot of humans doing things together. And we did that for the whole time. And there's a woman called Ellen Whitney Smith. She's a paleoanthropologist. Very, very cool job, I think. And she's searching for the complexity, because what we talk about here is like we lose in complexity and we find back easiness or simpleness in new forms all the time, and she's looking all over the ages, like gatherers and hunters, and she's discovering that we always had these steps of complexity, and always individually and as a society we managed a new step of complexity with our tools, with our philosophies, and how we organize ourselves as a society. So I think that is a pretty good question if we're looking on a different approach on a digital European identity in digital age, as in comparison to the Californian ideology, which is making everything one or zero. And I would like to give you two examples where you can reflect on. Yeah, sure, I know. I was listening also closely. So there's an initiative, a European initiative called META, Multilingual European Technology Alliance, and it's about a lot of research institutes taking care of the questions, are we losing the Vielfalt, wie heißt es, Vielfalt, the diversity of European languages in the digital age, because small languages are disappearing. Mm. And with languages disappearing, memes disappearing, and the way we interchange. Mm-hmm. So, and that's quite a nice thing. And the other thing is, on Wikipedia, many people don't know, in the back, there's a lot of change. The database of Wikipedia is changing because Wikipedia started Wikidata. So now everything in the back becomes structured data. And I just had a discussion about somebody who said, how can we structure paintings? You know, and as a European, I'm getting really, like, annoyed about somebody who wants to give me an Excel file, and he wants to have names on all the points. How we understand paintings in the future between zero and one? And I'm getting a little bit annoyed on that because I think there's a lot of things about paintings we cannot put in structured data.
Is there a question?
Can you please come to a question or just a comment?
I was trying to pushing the envelope, so we talked a lot about memes, so I thought we talked a little bit about European identity and what this has to do with it. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that was my inspiration. No question.
I think in terms of the languages, it is horrible to think of all the languages going extinct. I mean, there are thousands of languages now which are doomed. All living speakers are old, and they're not going to carry on. But this is only what's happened in biology all the time, and it's happening in a very similar way. Anyway, thank you for your thoughts. But I am completely ignorant about the concept of European, whatever you said, identity. So I can't say anything useful about that, I'm afraid.
Okay.
A firm European, I should say, and a United Kingdom person, we still are united.
Many things you said just refer to Norbert Wiener's idea in 1948, I think. I'm here.
Oh, you're there.
Yeah,
sorry.
In 1948, I think George Dyson will talk about it, about the computer as brain and the brain as a computer. But do you think right now there's anything in the Internet, if we take that as a metaphor for the one brain machine, that we didn't put in as human beings? Is there some self-replicating not only Google rankings or some anything new which is really beyond our input in this Internet?
I certainly do. It depends what you mean by what we put in. I mean, we put in the basic structure of digital information processing using certain things that could have been done in other ways. A different species evolving on a different planet, getting to this stage of wanting to communicate and inventing the equivalent of telephones and whatever, and writing and so on. It would come out different, but it would have the same principle. So, yeah, we put in digital, we put in English, we put in various programming languages and so on. But in terms of content, yes, absolutely. I would say there's masses of content out there that we never even see, and I think that's the really scary bit. One of the consequences of thinking about dreams, and if this really is, there really is dream evolution going on, is that once you have got the machinery, and I think we do have, that is doing all those three processes for itself, it's creating content all the time. Now, that content, well, yeah, we put it in the sense that it's going to be ones and zeros in a machine somewhere, but that's trivial, isn't it, really? In terms of the content, it could be language-based and in English, but it could be images, it could be all kinds of stuff, which we haven't had anything to do with beyond having set up the possibility of it's happening. Now, one of the really scary things about this is, this is a bit far-fetched, but I did say I was going to say some far-fetched things. I think it might be a bit like, dark matter. The physicists are saying, we do all the sums and everything. There's all this stuff which we can't see. In principle, we can't see it. We have to try and understand it in some other way. But we only know it's there because of its impact on the... Now, what would be the equivalent here would be all these dream machines up there, down here and standing stuff up there, are rapidly making new images, new bits of new programming, reprogramming things, inventing new programming languages for themselves or new programs anyway, doing all that stuff with no interference from us, with no contact with us. They'll be taking up space. So the first way that we'll know that's happening is that we'll be building more and more servers, far more than could conceivably be needed for the amount of traffic that we're actually generating ourselves. My guess is that that's probably happening already, but I do not know, but I think it will happen. And that's when the future of the planet is really dire, because we couldn't stop it without stopping all the things that we do want and have come used to. And we must be going on digging up the oil and the gas and everything in order to feed this growing monster of stuff that we didn't create. In a way, I hope I'm wrong, and I hope the right answer to your question is no, we made it all, and therefore we understand it. But yeah, well,
next
thank you for asking.
Over there, please. Here.
It interests me what you think about the effect. You have also children. I also have children. That the past is blowing up with this digital mass on pictures. I think this year so much pictures never in mankind. So they have all the memories and pictures and videos. And so normally the human structure is, okay, I have memories, but they will change. But if you have so much memories, your own videos, you don't select what is my real memory, what is my shown, that will be a great effect, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah. I'm perhaps not as worried as you are about that, but perhaps I should be. Partly because human visual memory is absolutely extraordinary. Not so much for bringing back memories, for retrieving visual memories, but for recognizing them. So if you show somebody 1,000 pictures and then they go off for a week and get on with their life, and then you bring them back in the lab and you show them 500 pictures that from that 1,000 and 500 other ones, they are incredibly accurate, 95%, you know, it depends on what the pictures are. Obviously, if you make them really, really similar, then they'll get muddled up. But basically, they'll go, yeah, familiarity, familiarity, familiarity. Now, how do we distinguish reality? And what's that in this world we're talking about? But sort of reality. My actual memories, I woke up this morning in the hotel, I opened the curtains, I was amazed, I couldn't even hear the trams going past. I mean, that's kind of my memory. How do I distinguish that from a video I saw of a different hotel? The answer is our brains are actually terribly good at that. It is extraordinary, given that we didn't evolve in a world like that. But on the whole, we are able to do that by situating the memory within a context. So when I remember some video I've seen of a hotel or whatever, it doesn't have any context. It doesn't make sense in a story. Whereas when I remember this morning, I can remember going to bed in the hotel. I can remember arriving in the hotel. It's the same with the difficulty we have distinguishing dreams from ordinary life. Most people don't have much trouble. And again, it's because of the context and the continuity of the story. I suppose lurking in your question there is it, are we getting so overwhelmed that that system will break down? Doesn't look like it yet. But another way of answering it would be, why is it that nowadays people are so stressed, so prone to depression and anxiety? A lot of that is overload, and perhaps that's the way it will show up. But I think we've got a way to go. The human brain is extraordinary. It is extraordinary that it can do things so well that it was never designed for. And that's a really interesting question. Asked in Darwin's time by Wallace... Alfred Wallace, who simultaneously came up with a very similar idea to Darwin's, he said that the human brain is surplus to requirements, and then that's why he brought God in, because it couldn't make sense, so he remained a believer, unlike Darwin, who actually saw the implications of his ideas for design. Not for any kind of God, but for a designer God. And that idea of our brains being surplus to requirements goes on in this context that you've just mentioned here. How come we're so good at it? Well, for the moment, I wouldn't worry too much about your I would worry about my children in other ways.
I have two more questions on the list over there first.
Thank you. So there are many questions one could raise from the point of view whether the brain was designed or not designed. This is a philosophical issue that we could go into.
But of course it was designed. I mean, it had to be designed.
Right.
It's a designed object. The question is, how was it designed? Which we might differ on.
We understand
but anyway, go on.
Each other. The question here is, going back to your hypothesis about what is actually happening today and the so-called singularity point of the computer becoming much more intelligent than the human brain or the human as a civilization, and this continues. Clearly, there is a change of paradigm. Social paradigm is changing. The question is, are we able to redesign capitalism, free market, and social layout of how we actually behave on time or not? This is the question. Can we change and humanize our existence and dealing with issues that you mentioned just a moment ago, depression and many other aberrations that are happening? I mean, people are online, you know, 24 hours a day, many of them. It's becoming an obsession for many.
Yeah.
Can we redesign on time and change, resync in line with the paradigm that has emerged? I mean, is there an upside potential here, is the question.
I suppose my most hopeful answer would be that by studying mimetics, thinking about dreams, thinking about all of these evolutionary processes, if we understand them well enough, then we should know how to not control them. You can't control an evolutionary process, but steer it in some way, you know. But steer it towards what? Steer it towards what we want. And unfortunately, I think this is one of the most fundamental things about human nature, is what we want isn't what makes us happy. We want loads of food and sugary, you know, sorts of food. We want endless entertainment. We want more choice. I mean, more choice just makes us more stressed, and, you know, the cognitive load from making choices all day long is enormous. But we think we want those things. So we want Twitter and Facebook, and I'm not on Twitter, I'm not on Facebook, I'm not on LinkedIn, I'm not on anything. But, you know, most people seem to want those things. So it's about manipulating human nature, and in the end. Why is capitalism so successful? Because humans are greedy, and, you know, and it keeps kind of emerging, and because it gets us more stuff. And in my opinion, what we ought to be doing is learning how to live with less stuff. We ought to be getting rid of most of the stuff we have. I mean, when I think about it, I could easily give up masses of the stuff I have, but I'm not going to do it because I like all this stuff. I'm not going to do it unless everybody else does. I care about this, and many years ago I decided I was never going to fly again. I thought, I can't justify flying. And so I did my last flight that I'd booked, said goodbye to America because there's no ships going anymore, and thought, that's it. And then I was invited to give a lecture at TED. And after many times of saying no, and eventually was persuaded to go, and I'm so glad I did. They persuaded me on the grounds that I'd have a podcast that would be, you know, more people would watch it, and I'd never have to go to a conference again. So I then decided I'd do one flight a year, and I did that for 5 years. And I really thought, you know, if scientists like myself do not make a stand, well, it's, you know, nothing's going to change. Well, nothing did change. You know, I was willing to do that, and it meant long, long train journeys and not going to amazing places that I was invited to go. Unless we can get governments or somebody in power to force us all to give up stuff, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen by the few voluntary people wanting to do it. It would be possible. I'm sure it would be possible. But, I mean, technically possible, but human nature is kind of in the way. Sorry, does that answer your question? I may have gone off on a tangent. Are we smart enough? Oh, yes, we're smart enough to make that change. But we're not motivationally able to want enough. There's a lot of psychology about what we want now and what we want in the future. And, you know, I bet you know about experiments with little kids, and you put a 3 or 4 year old in a room with a pile of marshmallows, and you say, if you sit here and wait till I come back, you can have all the marshmallows. But if you eat one, you can only have one. And the younger they are, the shorter time they can resist eating one. And, you know, grown-ups like you would be able to sit there and go, you probably wouldn't want marshmallow anyway, but you know what I mean. And this offsetting of the future against the past. But we're not very good at it. We can probably manage it with marshmallows, but we're pretty bad when it comes to addictive drugs and other things like that, but also food, but also gadgets. So it's not that we're not smart. It's not lack of smartness or intelligence. It's a lack of the foresight and being able to appreciate what's good for the future. Yeah, oh, leadership, absolutely. Where is our European leadership? I mean, I'm thinking about England more because I know more about it, but where is the European leadership that would say, the rest of the world might be doing terrible things, we're going to set an example, we can do things here, we can live a really good, fulfilling, wonderful human life with arts and sciences and joyful things that we do without all this stuff, without burning up the planet. Well, be our next leader. Solve the problems for us.
We're already over time, so I ask for a very short question, final question.
And a short answer.
A short answer, because okay. I think everybody wants to have a coffee, so and then we can continue
I'll try
the conversation.
To be short. I mean, your view seems to be a rather pessimistic one.
I try to make it not pessimistic, but it keeps going that way.
My view is a bit different because, I mean, human beings invented cars and planes. You're a bit concerned about planes and traffic in general. You've got religion, a lot of things invented, and somehow they run, and nobody's really controlling them. Nobody's controlling traffic, nobody's controlling religion. You now created the Internet, can be good or bad,
but somehow we are intelligent and smart enough to deal with that. So I really don't feel your concern. I mean, he loves Twitter. I don't really care. So I think we are able to deal with that and handle that.
I think if we had a population of, let's say, a billion on this planet, which would certainly be enough to have invented all this stuff and set it going. You do need a large number of people to do that. And we were not plundering the resources in the way that we are. If we had learnt about the problems of climate change and resource depletion earlier on in this process and acted accordingly, I might share your optimism. I would say, unfortunately, that population is the big problem. And we're not going to solve that problem anytime soon. The world might solve it for us. Ebola, I don't think it will be Ebola, but something like that might kill, you know, half the world's population, which would be absolutely horrendous for people, but it would, you know, or what? Wars don't kill enough people. It's usually diseases or famine. I mean, we don't want the world to be famine, but unless that happens, these machines are going to be sucking up so much stuff. Well, I said I'd be short. I will leave it there.
Thank you.
I hope your optimism is justified and my pessimism is somehow useful, making us think, but it's wrong.
And I guess there's time for sort of more intimate conversations and questions during the break. Thank you, Susan, for this great talk again.
Thank you.